Frank seized the janitor by the nose, squeezing hard enough to make the cartilage creak. "Chief Coombs. You'll call him Chief Coombs from now on."
"Okay," Dunphy cried. "I'll call him President Coombs if you just leave go of my schnoz."
"Return that property and we'll let this ride," Terry said, and was gratified by Frank's approving nod.
"Sure, you bet.
And don't you fuck the dog on this, because we'll be checking." The great thing about Frank, Terry realized during those first 3 days, was that he grasped the enormous pressure Terry was functioning under in a way that no one else seemed to. He never pressed, but he always had a suggestion, and nearly as important, he kept that leather-encased silver hip flask, very cool, maybe it was a black thing, at the ready for when Terry got low, when it seemed the day would never end and his wheels started spinning in the awful, surreal mud of it all. He was at Terry's elbow the entire time, stalwart as hell, and he was with him on Monday, Aurora plus 5, outside the gates of the dueling correctional facility for women. 3. Acting Chief Coombs had tried several times over the weekend to convince Clint that he needed to release Eve Black into his custody. Rumors about the woman who had killed the meth dealers were circulating. Unlike all the others, the stories went, she slept and woke. At the station, Linny Mars, still hanging in there, you go girl, had received so many calls regarding this that she had taken to hanging up on anyone who asked. Frank said they had to find out if the rumors were true. It was a priority. Terry supposed he was right, but Norcross was being stubborn, and Terry was finding it increasingly difficult to even get the annoying man on the phone. The fires had burned themselves out by Monday, but the countryside near the prison still smelled like an ashtray. It was gray and humid, and the misty rain that had been falling off and on since early Friday morning was falling again. Acting Chief of Police Terry Coombs, feeling mildewed, stood at the intercom and monitor outside the gates of the dueling correctional facility for women. Norcross still wasn't buying the transfer order that Judge Silver had signed for Eve Black. Frank had assisted with that, too, explaining to the judge that the woman might possess a unique immunity to the virus, and impressing on the old jurist the need to act quickly and keep things calm before a riot started. "Oscar Silver's got no jurisdiction in the matter, Terry." The doctor's voice burbled from the speaker, sounding as if it were coming from the bottom of a pond. "I know he signed her in at my wife's request, but he can't sign her out. Once he was remanded to me for evaluation, that was the end of his authority. You need a county judge now." Terry couldn't fathom why Lila's husband, who had always seemed down to earth, was being such a pain in the ass. "There's no one else right now, Clint. Judge Weiner and Judge Lewis are both asleep. Just our luck to have had a couple of female judges on the county circuit."
"All right, so go ahead and call Charleston and find out who they've appointed as interim," Clint said.
As if they'd come to a happy compromise. As if he'd given even a single damn inch.
"But why bother? Eve Black is now asleep like all the rest."
Hearing that put a lead ball in Terry's stomach. He should have known better than to believe a bunch of loose talk. Might as well try to question his own wife, a mummy in the basement dark, sprawled atop the dingy quilt on their old couch.
"She went down yesterday afternoon," Norcross continued. "We've only got a few inmates that are still awake."
"Then why won't he let us see her?" Frank asked. He had been standing silently throughout the exchange. It was a good question. Terry jabbed the call button and asked it.
"Look, here's what we'll do," said Clint. "I'll send you a picture on your cell phone, but I can't let anyone in. That's lockdown protocol. I've got the warden's book open right here in front of me. I'll read you what it says. State authorities must enjoin the facility and may remove the lockdown order at their discretion. State authorities."
"But don't butt me, Terry. I didn't write it. Those are the regulations.
Since Hicks walked off on Friday morning, I'm the only administrative officer this prison's got, and protocol is all I have to go on."
"But..." He was starting to sound like a two-cycle engine.
But... "I had to put us on lockdown. I had no choice. You've seen the same news I've seen. There are people going around torching women in their cocoons. I think you'll agree that my population would be a prime target for that breed of vigilante.
Oh, come on.
Frank made a hissing noise and shook his head. They hadn't been able to find a uniform shirt large enough to button across his chest, so Frank wore it open to his undershirt.
Sounds like a bunch of bureaucratic gobbledygook to me.
You're the acting chief, Terry. That's gotta trump a doctor, especially a shrink. Terry held up a hand to Frank.
I get all that, Clint. I understand your concern. But you know me, all right? I've worked with Lila for more than a decade, since before she was sheriff. You've eaten dinner at my house, and I've eaten dinner at yours. I'm not going to do anything to any of those women, so give me a break.
I'm trying.
You would not believe some of the garbage I've had to shovel up around town over the weekend. Some lady left her stove on and burned down half of Greeley Street. 100 acres of woods south of town are torched. I got a dead high school athlete who tried to rape a sleeper. I got a guy with his head smashed in by a blender. I mean, this is stupid. Let's put aside the rule book.
I'm acting chief of police. We're friends. Let me see she's sleeping like the others, and I'll get out of your hair.
The security kiosk on the opposite side of the fence, where an officer ought to have been stationed, was empty.
Beyond it, across the parking lot and on the opposite side of the second fence, the prison hunched its gray shoulders. There was no movement to be seen through the bulletproof glass of the front doors, no prisoners taking laps on the track or working in the garden plot. Terry thought of amusement parks in the late fall, the ramshackle appearance they took on when the rides stopped spinning and there were no kids walking around eating ice cream and laughing. Diana, his daughter, was grown now, but he'd taken her on countless amusement park trips when she was younger. Those had been fine times.
Christ, he could use a nip. Good thing Frank kept his cool flask handy.
Check your phone, Terry, came Clint's voice through the intercom speaker. The train whistle that was Terry's ringtone went off. He took his cell phone from his pocket and looked at the photograph that Clint had messaged him. A woman in a red top lay on a cell cot. There was an ID number above her breast pocket. Beside the ID number, an ID card had been placed. On the card was a photograph of a woman with long black hair, tan skin, and a wide, white smile. The name of the woman was listed as Eve Black, and her ID number matched the number on the uniform shirt. A cocoon had blotted out her face. Terry handed the phone to Frank so he could see the picture.
What do you think? Do we call it good?
It occurred to Terry that he, the acting chief, was fishing for a direction from his new deputy, when it was supposed to be the other way around. Frank studied the picture and said,
This doesn't prove jack shit. Norcross could put one on any sleeping woman and add Black's ID.
Frank returned the phone to Terry.
It doesn't make any sense, refusing to let us in. You're the law, Terry, and he's a goddamn prison psychiatrist. He is smoother than slippery elm, I'll give him that, but it smells. I think it's a stall game.
Frank was right, of course. The picture didn't prove anything. Why not allow them in to at least see the woman in the flesh, sleeping or not? The world was on the verge of losing half its population. What did some warden's rule book matter?
Why stall, though?
I don't know. Frank took out the flat flask and offered it. Terry thanked him, took a glorious swig of the whiskey, and offered the flask back. Frank shook his head.
Keep it handy.
Terry pocketed the flask and thumbed the intercom.
I gotta see her, Clint. Let me in, let me see, and we can all get on with our day. People are talking about her. I need to put the talk to rest. If I don't, we might have a problem I can't control.
4. From his seat in the booth, Clint observed the two men on the main monitor's feed. The door to the booth was open, as it never would have been under normal conditions, and Officer Tig Murphy was leaning in. Officers Quigley and Wettermore were just outside, also listening. Scott Hughes, the only other officer they had left, was taking a nap in an empty cell. A couple of hours after she'd shot Reed Dempster, Van Lampley had clocked out. Clint hadn't had the heart to ask her to stay.
Good luck, Doc,
she'd said, sticking her head in the door of his office, out of uniform and in her street clothes, eyes bloodshot from tiredness. Clint had wished her the same. She hadn't thanked him. If she wasn't asleep by now, he doubted she would have been of much use anyway. Clint was confident that he could put Terry off, at least for a while. What concerned him was the big guy standing beside Terry, who had given the acting chief the flask and was advising him between exchanges. In a way, it was like watching a ventriloquist and his talking dummy. Clint noticed the way the big guy was scanning around instead of staring at the intercom speaker, as people instinctively tended to do. It was like he was casing the place. Clint depressed his intercom button and spoke into the mic.
"Honestly, I'm not trying to complicate things, Terry. I feel terrible about this. Not to beat a dead horse, but I swear, I've got the warden's book right here in front of me. It's in capital letters at the top of the lockdown ordinances."
He tapped the electronics board in front of him, on which there rested no book of any kind.
"This wasn't what I was trained for, Terry, and the book is all I have."
"Clint," he could hear Terry's disgusted exhalation.
"What the heck, man? Am I gonna have to bust down the gate? This is ridiculous. Lila would be really disappointed. Really disappointed. She won't believe this."
"I understand you're frustrated, and I know I can't even begin to appreciate the stress you've been under the last couple of days, but you do realize there's a camera on you, right? I just watched you take a drink from a flask, and we both know that it wasn't Kool-Aid. With all due respect, I knew Lila." The mention of his wife in the past tense, realized only as soon as it was out of his mouth, caused Clint's heart to catch. To get himself a moment, he cleared his throat.
"I know Lila a little better than you, and that's what I think would disappoint her, that her go-to deputy is drinking on the job. Put yourself in my position. Would you let someone into the prison who doesn't have jurisdiction or the right paperwork, and who's been drinking?"
They watched Terry throw up his hands and walk away from the intercom, pacing in a circle. The other man put an arm around his shoulder and spoke to him. Tig shook his head and chuckled.
"You should never have gone into prison medicine, Doc. You could have been rich selling shit on HSN. You just did major voodoo on that guy. He's gonna need therapy now."
Clint swiveled to the three officers standing by. "Anybody know the other one? The big dude?" Billy Wettermore did.
"That's Frank Geary, the local animal control officer. My niece helps out with the strays. She told me he's okay, but kind of intense."
"Intense how?"
"He really doesn't like people who don't take care of their animals or abuse them. There was a rumor that he put a beat down on a redneck who tortured a dog or cat or something, but I wouldn't bet all my money on that one. High school grapevine has never been too reliable."
It was on the tip of Clint's tongue to ask Billy Wettermore to give his niece a ring before he remembered how unlikely it was that she'd still be awake. Their own female population was down to a grand total of three: Angel Fitzroy, Jeanette Sorley, and Eve Black. The woman he'd photographed was an inmate named Wanda Danker, who had a body type similar to Evie's. Danker had been conked out since Friday night. In preparation, they dressed her in scrubs with Evie's ID number and Evie's ID pinned to her red top. Clint was grateful, and a little stunned, that the crew of four remaining officers had bought into what he was doing. He told them that since word of Evie's sleeping and waking was public knowledge, it was inevitable that someone, probably the cops, would come for her. He hadn't attempted to pitch Tig Murphy and Rand Quigley and Billy Wettermore and Scott Hughes on the idea that Evie was some sort of fantastic being whose safety, and by extension the safety of every woman in existence, depended on Clint. He had a great deal of confidence in his ability to talk a person around to a new way of seeing things. He'd been doing exactly that for nearly two decades. But this was an idea that not even he dared attempt to sell. The tack Clint had taken with Dueling Correctional's remaining officers was simpler. They couldn't hand Evie over to locals. Moreover, they couldn't play it straight with them, because as soon as they acknowledged that Evie was different, they'd only become more relentless. Whatever the deal with Evie was, whatever immunity she possessed, it needed to be sorted out by serious scientists from the federal government who knew what the hell they were doing. It didn't matter that the town authorities probably had a comparable plan in mind, to have a doctor examine her, to question her about her background, and perform every test you could perform on a person who seemed to have a unique biology. Which sounded okay. But, as Terry might have said, but. She was too precious to risk. That was the but. If they handed Evie over to the wrong people and things went sideways, if someone lost their temper and killed her, perhaps out of simple frustration, perhaps because they needed a scapegoat, what good would she be then to anyone's mothers and wives and daughters? And forget Evie as an interview subject, Clint told his very thin blue line. She couldn't or wouldn't tell anyone anything. She seemed not to have the remotest idea of what was so special about her biology. Plus, immune or not, Eve Black was a psychopath who'd planted a pair of meth cookers. Someone could still, like, study her body and her DNA and such, couldn't they? Rand Quigley and hopefully proposed. Even if her brains are blown out? He added hastily, I'm just saying. I'm sure they could, Rand, said Clint. But don't you think that's not optimal? It's probably better if we keep her brains in. They might be useful. Rand had conceded as much. Meanwhile, for the benefit of this scenario, Clint had been making regular calls to the CDC. Since the guys in Atlanta didn't answer, repeated calls yielded nothing but a recorded announcement or the same busy signal as on the Thursday the crisis started. He was discussing matters with a branch of the CDC that happened to be located on the second floor of an empty house on Tremaine Street. Its number was Lila's cell phone, and Jared and Mary Pack were the only scientists on the staff. This is Norcross again at Dueling Correctional in West Virginia, began the play that Clint performed over and over, with minor variations for the ears of his remaining officers. Your son is asleep, Mr. Norcross, was how Mary replied at the start of their latest go-round. May I please kill him? That's a negative, Clint said. Black is still sleeping and waking. She's still extremely dangerous. We still need you to come and get her. Mrs. Pack and Mary's younger sister had both fallen asleep by Saturday morning, and her out-of-town father was still attempting to make his way back from Boston. Rather than stay home alone, Mary had tucked her mother and sister into bed and gone to join Jared. To the two teenagers, Clint had been honest, mostly. He had omitted some things. He had told them that there was a woman in the prison who slept and woke, and asked them to participate in the CDC rigmarole because he said he was worried that the staff would give up and walk if it didn't seem like he was talking to someone and that help was imminent. The parts he'd left out were about Evie, her impossible knowledge, and the deal she'd offered him. My pee is pure monster energy drink, Mr. Norcross. When I move my arms fast, there are, like, traces in the air that I see. Does that make sense? Oh, probably not, but whatever. I think this might be my superhero origin story, and Jared is in his sleeping bag, missing the excitement. I'm going to have to dribble spit in his ear if he doesn't wake up soon. This was the part where Clint increasingly flashed a show of annoyance. That's all fascinating, and I certainly hope you'll take whatever steps are necessary, but let me repeat. We need you to come and extract this woman and get to work on whatever makes her different. Capiche? Call me as soon as you have a helicopter en route. Your wife is okay, Mary said. Her euphoria had abruptly dampened. Well, not changed. You know, the same. Resting comfortably. Thank you, said Clint. The entire structure of logic he'd constructed was so rickety that Clint wondered how much Billy and Rand and Tig and Scott truly believed, and how much of it was the officers craving something to dedicate themselves to amid an emergency that was as amorphous as it was nightmarish. And there was another motivation in play. Simple but strong, the territorial imperative. In the view of Clint's small cadre of shields, the prison was their patch, and townies had no business messing in it. These factors had allowed them, for a few days at least, to keep doing the job they were accustomed to, albeit with fewer and fewer prisoners that needed attending. They found comfort in doing the job in familiar surroundings. The five men took shifts sleeping on the couch in the officers' break room and cooking in the prison kitchen. It also may have helped that Billy, Rand, and Scott were young and unmarried, and that Tig, the oldest of the bunch by 20 years, was divorced without kids. They had even seemed to acclimate, after some grumbling, to Clint's insistence that everyone's safety depended on no more personal calls being made. And accordingly, they had abetted him in the most distasteful measure he'd been forced to make. Under the pretext of emergency security regulations, they had used tin snips to amputate the receivers from the 3 payphones available for the use of the prisoners, and deprived the population, in what might well be their last days, from any opportunity to communicate with their loved ones. This precaution had led to the breaking out of a small riot on Friday afternoon, when half a dozen prisoners had made a charge for the administration wing. It had not been much of a riot. The women were exhausted, and, except for one inmate wielding a sock filled with dead batteries, they had been unarmed. The 4 officers had quickly put the insurrection down. Clint didn't feel good about it, but if anything, the attack had probably served to strengthen his officers' resolve. How long the men would stay resolved, Clint couldn't hazard a guess. He just hoped they could be persuaded to hang on until he could either change Evie's mind and get her to cooperate in a way that made sense, or the sun rose on Tuesday or Wednesday or Thursday or whenever, and she was satisfied. If what she claimed was true. If it wasn't, then it didn't matter. But until it didn't matter, it did. Clint felt bizarrely energized. A lot of bad shit had happened, but at least he was doing something. Unlike Lila, who had given up. Jared had found her in Mrs. Ransom's driveway. She had let herself fall asleep in her car. Clint told himself he didn't blame her. How could he? He was a doctor. He understood the body's limits. Once you went without sleep long enough, you fragmented, lost your sense of what was important and what wasn't, lost your sense of what was even real, lost yourself. She'd broken down, that was all. But he couldn't break down. He had to make things right. Like he'd made things right with Lila before Aurora had taken her, by staying strong and persuading her to see reason. He had to try to resolve this crisis. Bring his wife home, bring them all home. Trying was the only thing left. Evie might be able to stop it. Evie might be able to wake Lila up. She might be able to wake all of them up. Clint might get her to see reason. The world might be returned to normal. Despite everything that Clint knew about the science of medicine, everything that said that Evie Black was just a mad woman with delusions of grandeur, too much had happened for him to entirely refute her claims. Madwoman or not, she had powers. Her lacerations had healed in less than a day. She knew things she couldn't know. Unlike every other woman on the planet, she slept and woke. The big man, Geary, slipped his fingers through the fencing of the front gate and gave it an experimental shake. Then he crossed his arms and peered at an electronic lock the size of a boxing glove. Clint saw this, noted how Terry had wandered off to tow the dirt at the roadside and nip at the flask, and concluded that serious trouble might be brewing down the road, and maybe not that far down. He tapped the intercom. "Hi there. So are we all set? Terry? And Frank? You're Frank, aren't you? Nice to meet you. You got the picture?" Instead of responding, the new deputy and the acting chief went back to their police car, climbed in, and departed. Frank Geary drove. 5. There was a scenic turnout halfway between the prison and the town. Frank swung in and cut the engine.
"Isn't this a sight?" he said in a low, marveling voice. "You'd think the world was just the same as it was last week."
Frank was right, Terry thought. It was a fine view. They could see all the way to Ball's Ferry and beyond, but it was hardly time to admire the countryside.
Frank, I think we should
discuss it.
Frank nodded emphatically.
Just what I was thinking.
My take's pretty simple.
Norcross may be a psychiatrist or whatever, but his advanced degree must have been in bullshit. He gave us a classic runaround, and he's going to keep on doing it until we refuse to accept it.
I guess.
Terry was thinking of what Clint had said about drinking on the job. He was probably right, and Terry was willing to admit, if only to himself, that he was close to being drunk right now. It was just that he felt so overwhelmed. Chief was no job for him. When it came to law enforcement, he was strictly deputy class.
What we need here is closure, Chief Coombs. Not just for us, for everyone. We need access to the woman in the picture he sent. We need to cut open the webs over her face and make sure it's the same face as the woman in the ID photo. If that turns out to be the case, we can go to Plan B.
Which is what? Frank reached into his pocket, produced a pack of bubble gum, peeled a piece out of its wrapper.
Fuck if I know.
Cutting the cocoons is dangerous, Terry said. People have died.
Which makes it damn lucky that you've got a certified animal control specialist on your team. I've dealt with some mean dogs in my time, Terry, and once I got called out to deal with a very pissed off bear that managed to wrap himself up in barbed wire. To deal with Ms. Black, I'll use my biggest catchpole, the Tomahawk 10-foot. Stainless steel, spring lock. Drop the noose around her neck before snipping the shit over her face. Yank it as tight as I have to when she starts to buck and snap. She might lose consciousness, but it won't kill her. The stuff will grow back, and when it does, she'll go sleepy by again. All we need is a look, that's all. A quick look.
If it's her and all the chatter turns out to be bullshit, everybody's gonna be disappointed, Terry said. Including me.
Me too. Frank was thinking of Nana. But we have to know. You see that, don't you?
Terry did.
Yeah. The question is, how do we get Norcross to give us access? We could raise a posse, and we might have to, but that's a last resort, don't you think?
Yes. Terry found the idea of a posse unpleasant, bordering on stomach churning. In the current situation, a posse might well turn into a mob.
We could use his wife.
Huh?
Terry stared at Frank. Lila? Say what?
Offer a swap, he said.
You give us Eve Black, we give you your wife.
Why would he go for that? Terry asked. He knows we'd never hurt her.
When Frank didn't reply to this, Terry grabbed Frank by the shoulder. We would never hurt her, Frank. Never. You get that, right?
Frank shook loose.
Of course I do.
He showed Terry a smile.
I'm talking about running a bluff, but it's one he might believe. They're burning cocoons in Charleston. Just panicky social media-driven bullshit, I know, but lots of people believe it. And Norcross might believe we believe it. Also, he has a son, right?
Yeah, Jared, nice kid.
He might believe it. He might be persuaded to call his dad and tell him to give the black woman up.
Because what, we threatened to burn his mother like a mosquito on a bug light? Terry couldn't believe the words he was hearing himself say. No wonder he was drinking on the job. Look at the kind of discussion he was being forced to have.
Frank chewed his gum.
I don't like it, Terry said.
Threatening to burn up the chief, I don't like it a bit.
I don't like it either, Frank said, and this was the truth. But desperate times sometimes call for desperate measures.
No, Terry said, for the moment not feeling drunk at all. Even if one of the teams find her, it's a flat no. And hell, for all we know, she's still awake. Put on her boogie shoes and blew town. Left her husband and son? Left her job with things messed up like they are? You believe that?
Probably not, Terry said.
One of the teams will find her eventually, but using her that way is still a no. Cops don't make threats. And cops don't take hostages.
Frank shrugged.
Message received. It was just an idea.
He turned around to face out through the windshield, started the engine, and backed Unit 4 onto the highway.
I suppose somebody checked Norcross's house for her?
Reed Barrows and Vern Rangel yesterday. She and Jared are both gone. Place is empty.
The boy, too, Frank said thoughtfully.
Babysitting her somewhere, maybe? Could have been the shrink's idea.
He ain't dumb, I'll give him that.
Terry didn't reply.
Part of him thought having another nip was a bad idea, but part of him thought one more couldn't hurt.
He fished the flask out of his pocket, unscrewed the cap, and offered it to Frank first, which was only polite, since it was his. Frank smiled and shook his head.
Not while I'm driving, amigo.
5 minutes later, as they were passing the Olympia Diner, the sign out front no longer attempted to entice passersby with the promise of egg pie. Now it read, "Pray for our women." Something the head shrinker had said over the intercom came to Frank.
Since Hicks walked off on Friday morning, I'm the only administrative officer this prison's got.
His big hands clamped down on the wheel, and the cruiser swerved. Terry, who had been dozing, snapped awake.
What?
Nothing,
Frank said. Thinking about Hicks, wondering what Hicks knew, wondering what Hicks had seen. But for now, he would keep these questions to himself.
Everything's fine, Chief. Everything's fine.
Six.
What pissed Evie off about the video game were the blue stars. Multicolored triangles, stars, and fiery orbs rained down the screen. You needed a string of 4 fiery orbs in order to explode 1 sparkling blue star. Other shapes flashed and disappeared if you linked up chains of them, but the sparkling blue stars were apparently made of some almost adamantine material that only the incendiary force of the fiery orbs could shatter. The name of the game was, for no rationale that Evie could grasp, Boomtown. She was on level 15, teetering on extinction. A pink star appeared, then a yellow triangle, and then finally, thank fuck, a fiery orb, which Evie tried to slide left to a stack of 3 fiery orbs that she'd already amassed alongside a blue star that was clogging up that area of her screen. But then came a green death triangle, and that was all she wrote.
"Sorry, you died," proclaimed a flashing message. Evie groaned and flipped Hicks's phone onto the far end of her cot. She wanted as much distance as possible between herself and the wicked thing. Eventually, of course, it was going to suck her back in. Evie had seen dinosaurs. She had looked down upon the great forests of America from the eyes of a passenger pigeon. She had surfed into Cleopatra's sarcophagus atop a flume of desert sand and caressed the glorious queen's dead face with beetle legs. A playwright, a clever Englishman, had written an amusing, if not entirely accurate, speech about Eve once. "She is the fairy's midwife, and she comes in shape no bigger than an agate stone on the forefinger of an alderman, drawn with a team of little atomies athwart men's noses as they lie asleep. As an enchanted being, she should be able to do better than level 15 of Boomtown."
"You know, Jeanette, they say the natural world is cruel and stupid, but that little machine... that little machine is a very good argument in and of itself that technology is a lot worse. Technology is, I would say, the actual Boomtown."
7. Jeanette was nearby, pacing the short A-wing corridor. She was now, it seemed, the head trustee. She was also the only trustee. But Jeanette had paid attention during the career counseling sessions about post-prison life. When composing your resume, it was incumbent upon you to make the most of your achievements and to let the person who was doing the hiring decide what was and was not significant. The title was hers. While the 4 remaining officers walked B and C wings and kept an eye on the prison's perimeter, Dr. Norcross had asked if she would mind keeping an eye on the other 2 inmates whenever he had to step out.
"Sure," said Jeanette. "I'm not busy. Seems like furniture shop got canceled."
It was good to have work. It kept her mind occupied. She shuffled forward. In front of her, the triple-plated, wire-gridded window in the west wall showed a gray morning. There was standing water on the running track, and the fields looked marshy.
"I never liked video games," Jeanette said.
It had taken her a while to construct her response to Evie. She had been awake for 96 hours.
"More proof of your excellent character, my dear,"
Evie said. Angel, in the neighboring cell, now entered the discussion.
"Excellent character? Jeanette? Shit. She killed her fucking husband, you know. Stabbed him. Didn't even use a knife like a normal person would. Done it with a screwdriver. Ain't that right, Jeanette?"
Rapper Angel was gone. Redneck Angel was back. Jeanette figured she was too tired to make rhymes. That was good. On balance, Redneck Angel was less annoying and more, Jeanette struggled for the word, more authentic.
"I do know that, Angel, and I give her credit for it."
"Wish she'd let me kill you," Angel said. "I think I'd get to your juggler with my teeth. I think I would."
She made a humming noise.
"No, I would."
"Would you like to have a turn with the phone, Angel? Jeanette, if I give you the phone through the tray slot, will you give it to Angel?"
Evie's tone was conciliatory. There was talk that the beautiful woman in the soft cell was either a sorceress or a demon. Moths had poured from her mouth. Jeanette had seen them. Whatever Evie was, it seemed that she wasn't immune to Angel's taunts.
"I bet I could make you swallow that phone,"
Angel said.
"Bet you couldn't," said Evie.
"Could."
Jeanette stopped at the window in the wall, placed her hand against the glass, and let herself lean there. She didn't want to fantasize about sleep, and couldn't stop fantasizing about it. Of course, there were prisons even in sleep. Jeanette had on many occasions waited to be let out of a dream cell, as bored as all the times she waited in her actual life to be let out of her actual cell. But sleep was also a beach, and the waves cleaned it up every night, all the footprints and bonfires and sandcastles and beer cans and scraps of trash. Those cleansing waves washed most every trace into the depths. Sleep was also Bobby. He had met her in a forest that had grown over the ruins of the bad old world, and everything was better. Would Ree be in her sleep, her dreams? Damien was in there, so why not Ree? Or was the sleep that came with the cocoons dreamless? Jeanette remembered, some days, waking up feeling so young and strong and healthy.
"I'm ready to whip my weight in Wildcats,"
she sometimes told Bobby when he was just little. She couldn't imagine feeling that way now, or ever again. When he was a newborn, Bobby had given her some hard nights.
"What do you want?"
she would ask him. He just cried and cried. She imagined that he hadn't actually known what he wanted, but hoped maybe his mother might, and fix it for him. That was the hurtful part of motherhood, not being able to fix what you couldn't understand. Jeanette wondered if she even could sleep now. What if she had broken her sleep bone? Sleep muscle? Sleep tendon? Her eyes felt terribly dry. Her tongue felt like it was too big. Why didn't she give in? Simple. Because she didn't want to. She had given in to Damien, and she had given in to drugs, and her life had gone exactly the way everyone said it would go. She wasn't giving in to this. This wasn't going how they expected it to go. She counted to 60, got lost in the 40s, returned to 1, and the second time made it up to 100. She shoots, she scores. Let's go to the videotape.
What was that guy's name? The let's go to the videotape guy?
Dr. Norcross would remember. Jeanette was facing the east wall, where the metal door of the shower gave on the delousing area. She walked toward the door, right, left, right, left. A man crouched on the floor, pinching buds into a cigarette paper. Behind her, Angel was explaining to Evie how she'd peel off her skin, how she'd dig out her eyes, fry them up with some ramps, and eat them. Ramps would flavor up any rotten morsel. And on from there, more bibble-babble, tone and accent. Angry, angry, angry. Country, country, country. At this point, unless Jeanette really focused, conversation, pretty much anything anyone said, was low-volume radio gab. She kept expecting to hear an 800 number.
"You know, Angel, I don't think I will be sharing my Boomtown video game with you after all," Evie said.
And Jeanette went right-left, right-left,
locking on the differently colored notices on the bulletin board by the Quell dispenser, the words too bleary to read but knowing that they were lists of church services, AA meetings, crafts classes, and reminders of rules. On one piece of paper, a girl elf was dancing over the words, "I'm on good report." Jeanette shuffled to a stop and flashed a look at the spot where the man had been squatting. There was no one.
"Hello? Hey, where'd you go?"
"Jeanette, are you all right?"
"Uh-huh."
Jeanette glanced back at Evie's cell door. The strange woman stood at the bars. She wore a melancholy expression, a well-of-course expression, like you did when you had a hope that you knew wasn't too realistic. And sure enough, life did what life did with unrealistic hopes. It was the face babies made after a cat scratched them and right before they cried.
"I just thought I saw someone."
"You're beginning to hallucinate. That's what happens when you don't sleep. You should go to sleep, Jeanette. It'll be safer for you if you're asleep when the men come."
Jeanette shook her head. "I don't want to die."
"You won't. You'll sleep. And then you'll wake up somewhere else." Evie's face lit. "And you'll be free." When it came to Evie, Jeanette couldn't think straight. She seemed crazy, but not crazy like anyone else Jeanette had met in Dueling Correctional. Some insane people were so close to blowing up you could almost hear them tick. Angel was like that. Evie seemed like something else, and not just because of the moths. Evie seemed inspired.
"What do you know about free?"
"I know everything about free," said Evie. "Shall I give you an example?"
"If you want."
Jeanette risked another look at the spot where the man had been sitting. No one was there. No one. You find creatures in the dark of the earth, far below the rubble of the mountaintops that the coal men have chopped flat. Eyeless creatures that are freer than you have ever been. Because they live as they want to, Jeanette. They are fulfilled in their darkness. They are everything they want to be. Evie repeated this last, emphasizing it. They are everything they want to be. Jeanette pictured herself in a warm darkness far beneath the earth's surface. Minerals glittered around her in constellations. She felt small and secure. Something tickled her cheek. She opened her eyes, brushed at the strand of web that had started to curl up from her skin. She wobbled on her feet. She hadn't even realized she'd closed her eyes. In front of her, not halfway across the room, was the wall, bulletin board, door to the shower, Quell dispenser, cement blocks. Jeanette took a step, then another. There was the man. He was back, now smoking the joint he had rolled. Jeanette wasn't going to look at him. She wasn't giving in. She was going to touch the wall, and then she was going to turn around and walk to the other wall, and she wasn't giving in. Jeanette Sorley wasn't ready to be enshrouded yet. "I can go a while," she thought. "I can go a while. You just watch me." 8. All the regular cruisers were taken. So Don Peters and the kid he was partnered with scoured the grid of suburban streets just south of the high school in Don's Dodge Ram. It had no official insignia, which was disappointing. Don planned to see about that later, maybe get some stick-on letters from the hardware store. But there was a battery-powered bubble light on the dashboard, revolving slowly, and he was wearing his prison officer's uniform. The kid didn't have any kind of uniform, of course, just a plain blue shirt with a badge on it. But the Glock on his hip carried all the additional authority he needed. Eric Blass was only 17, technically 4 years too young to be in law enforcement. Don thought the kid had the right stuff, though. He'd been a life scout with a merit badge in target shooting before giving up the scouting program the year before. "Too many pussies," Blass had said, to which Don replied, "Copy that, Junior." Besides, the kid was funny. He had invented a game to speed the hours. It was called Zombie Chicks. Don had the left side of the street since he was driving. Eric had the right. It was 5 points for old chicks,
10 points for middle-aged chicks, 15 points for kitty chicks, hardly any of those left by Saturday, none at all today, and 20 points for hotties. Blass was currently up, 80-55, only as they turned onto St. George Street, that was about to change.
"Hottie on the left at 2 o'clock, Don said. "That puts me up to 75, closing in on you, Junior."
The kid, riding shotgun, leaned forward to scrutinize the youngish woman stumbling along the sidewalk in spandex shorts and a sports bra. Her head was down, her sweaty hair swinging back and forth in clumps. Maybe she was trying to run, but the best she could manage was a half-assed, weaving jog.
"Saggy tits and saggy ass," Eric said. "If that's what you call a hottie, I pity you."
"Oh, geez, pack your bags. We're going on a guilt trip," Don cackled.
"Fine, since we can't see the face, how about I call it 15?
"Works for me," Eric said. "Give her a honk." As they rolled slowly by the staggering woman, Don laid on the horn. The woman's head jerked up. The face was not too bad, actually, except for the big purple circles under her hollowed-out eyes. And she stumbled. Her left foot caught on her right ankle, and she sprawled on the pavement.
"She's down!" Eric yelled. "Chick goes down!"
He craned to look over his shoulder.
"But wait! She's getting up! Not even waiting for the 8 count!
He began to toot the Rocky theme through flapping lips. Don glanced in the rearview mirror and saw the woman rising shakily to her feet. Her knees were scraped, and blood was trickling down her shins. He thought she might give them the finger. The teenager they'd blasted shortly after their shift began had done that. But the zombie chick didn't even look around. Just went staggering off toward downtown. Don said,
"Did you see the look on her face?"
"Priceless," Eric said, and raised his palm. Don high-fived him. They had a list of streets to be canvassed, tucked into a notebook where they wrote down the addresses of houses containing sleeping women, plus their names and some form of ID. If the houses were locked, they were allowed to break in, which was fun at first. Don enjoyed washing his hands with different kinds of soap and different kinds of bathrooms, and the variety of styles and colors of panties in the underwear drawers of the women of dueling was a subject that had long called for his study. Cheap thrills wore out, though. It wasn't real action. Without an ass to fill them out, panties got old fast. When you came right down to it, he and Junior were little more than census takers.
"This is Ellendale Street, right?"
Don said as he pulled the ram to a curb.
"Roger that, El Comandante. All 3 blocks of it."
"Well, let's get walking, partner. Check out some bitch bags and write down some names." But before Don could open the driver's side door, Eric grabbed his arm. The newbie was looking toward a patch of waste ground between Ellendale and the high school.
"You want to have some fun, boss?"
"Always up for fun," Don said. "It's my middle name. What have you got in mind?"
"You burned one yet?"
"A cocoon?"
"No."
Don had seen footage on the news, though. A cell phone video of a couple of guys in hockey masks putting a match to one. The news called guys like that blowtorch brigades. The cocoon in the video had gone up like a campfire wetted down with gasoline.
Whoosh!
"Have you?"
"Nope,"
Eric said. "But I heard they, you know, really burn like crazy."
"What are you thinking?"
"There's an old homeless babe who lives over there," Eric pointed. "If you want to call that living, that is. No good to herself or anyone else. We could give her a hot foot, just to see what it's like, you know. It's not like anybody would miss her." Eric suddenly looked uneasy.
"Of course, if you don't want to."
"I don't know if I do or not," Don said. This was a lie. He wanted to, all right. Just thinking about it had gotten him a little horny.
"Let's check her out, then decide. We can do Ellendale later."
They got out of the truck and headed for the weed-choked acre of ground where old Essie kept her den. Don had a Zippo lighter. He took it from his pocket and began to click it open and shut. Open and shut. Chapter 2. 1. The women started out just calling it the new place, because it wasn't really dueling anymore, not the dueling they'd known, at least. Later, as they began to realize they might be here for the long haul,
It became our place. The name stuck. 2. The meat tasted strongly of the lighter fluid it took to ignite the ancient charcoal from Mrs. Ransom's basement, but they ate the entire shank that Lila had hacked from the body of the bobcat she'd shot with her service revolver and dragged out of the fetid swimming pool.
"We are sick puppies," said Molly on that first night, licking the grease from her fingers and grabbing another chunk. Being a sick puppy didn't seem to sit too badly with her.
"Got that right, my darling," her grandmother said. "But I'm damned if this isn't half decent eatin'. Grab me another piece, Mrs. Chief of Police."
They had taken shelter in the remains of Mrs. Ransom's house, not trying anything from the dusty canned goods in the pantry because Lila was afraid of botulism. They subsisted for the next 2 weeks primarily on berries they picked from the bushes in their former suburban neighborhood, and tiny ears of wild corn, tough and almost tasteless, but at least edible. May was too early for berries and corn, but there it was. From this, Lila drew a conclusion, shaky at first, but growing more solid. The version of dueling where they found themselves was moving at a different pace in time from the dueling they had been in before. Time felt the same, but it wasn't. Mrs. Ransom confirmed that she had been alone for several days before Molly appeared. The hours in the old place, before, were days in the new one. Now? Maybe more than days. This concern with the differing time streams most often occupied Lila in the loose minutes before sleep took her. Many of the places they slept were open to the sky. Fallen trees had punched holes in some roofs, wind had snatched others away altogether, and Lila blinked at the stars as she drifted off. The stars were the same, but their glare was shocking. They were hot white welding sparks. Was it even real, this world without men? Was it heaven? Purgatory? An alternate universe on an alternate time stream? More women and girls arrived. The population began to snowball, and although Lila didn't want the job, she found herself in charge. By default, it seemed. Dorothy Harper of the curriculum committee and her friends, three cheerful white-haired women in their 70s, who introduced themselves as book club chums, emerged from the scrub forest that had risen around a condo. They made a great fuss over Molly, who enjoyed being fussed over. Janice Coates arrived strolling down Main Street, a leaf stuck in the ruins of her perm, accompanied by three women in prison red tops. Janice and the three former inmates, Kitty McDavid, Celia Frode, and Nell Seeger, had needed to hack their way through a thicket to get out of Dueling Correctional.
"Good afternoon, ladies," Janice said after embracing first Blanche McIntyre, then Lila.
"Forgive our appearance. We just broke jail. Now, which one of you nicked your finger on a spindle and created this mess?"
Some of the old dwellings were habitable and salvageable. Others were fabulously overgrown or crumbled, or both. On Main Street, they gaped at the high school, which had been an outmoded building even in the old dueling. In this new one, it was literally split down the middle, each half of the structure leaning to opposite sides, and open air in between jagged brick edges. Birds perched on the cliffs of classroom lino that jutted out into space. The municipal building, which had included the town and police department offices, was half-collapsed. A sinkhole had opened on Malloy. A car sat at the bottom, submerged to the windshield in coffee-colored water. A woman named Kaylee Rawlings joined the colony and volunteered her experience as an electrician. It was no surprise to the former warden, who knew that Kaylee had gone to vocational school to learn about wiring and voltage. That Kaylee and her education had emerged from inside the fence of Dueling Correctional was not an issue. The woman had never committed a crime in this new place, under these two bright stars. Kaylee managed to resurrect a solar-powered generator attached to what had once been a rich doctor's house, and they cooked rabbit on his electric stovetop and listened to old records on his vintage Rockola jukebox. In the evenings, they talked. Most of the women had, like Lila in the cruiser in Mrs. Ransom's driveway,
awakened in the places where they had fallen asleep. A few others, however, remembered finding themselves in the dark, hearing nothing but wind and birdsong and, perhaps, distant voices. When the sun had risen, these women had picked their way west through woods and come out either on Balls Hill Road or West Lavin. To Lila, the picture they drew of those early moments was of a world being formed, as if the surroundings of their existence was an act of collective imagination. That, she thought, was as likely as anything else. 3. Day followed day, and night followed night. Exactly how many from the first day, no one was sure, but weeks, certainly, and then months. A hunting and gathering group was formed. There was a great deal of game, deer and rabbit especially, as well as plenty of wild fruits and vegetables. They never came close to starving. There was a farming group, a construction group, a health care group, and an education group to teach the children. Each morning, a different girl stood out in front of the little school, ringing a cowbell. The sound carried for miles. Women taught. Some of the older girls did, too. No viruses afflicted them, though there were many cases of poison ivy to deal with, and more than a few cuts and bruises, even broken bones brought about by the perils inherent in long-abandoned structures, sharp edges and bucklings and hidden traps. If this world was an act of imagination, Lila sometimes thought as she drifted toward sleep, it was a remarkably strong one if it could make people bleed. In the basement of the high school, where some variety of mold had made a feast of the filing cabinets full of decades-old school board transcripts, Lila unearthed a mimeograph machine that had probably not been used since the mid-60s. It was packed neatly away in a plastic crate. Some of the erstwhile prison inmates turned out to be remarkably crafty. They helped Molly Ransom make fresh ink from swamp red currants, and the girl founded a single-sheet newspaper called Dueling Doings. The first headline was School Reopens, and she quoted Lila Norcross as saying, "It's nice to see the kids getting back into their routine." Molly asked Lila what her title was, dueling chief of police or plain sheriff. Lila said to just call her a local. And there were the meetings. These took place once a week initially, then twice, and lasted an hour or two. Although they turned out to be extremely important to the health and well-being of the women living in our place, they came about almost by accident. The first attendees were the ladies who had called themselves the First Thursday Book Club in the old world. In this new one, they got together in the Shopwell supermarket, which had held up remarkably well. And they had enough to talk about without a book to get them started. Blanche, Dorothy, Margaret, and Margaret's sister Gail sat on folding chairs at the front of the store, chatting about all the things they missed. These included fresh coffee and orange juice, air conditioning, television, garbage pickup, the internet, and being able to just power up a phone and call a friend. Mostly, though, they all agreed on this. They missed men. Younger women began to drift in and were welcomed. They talked about the gaps in their lives, places of absence that had once been filled by their sons, nephews, fathers, grandfathers, and their husbands. "Let me tell you girls something," Rita Coombs said at a meeting toward the end of that first summer. By then, there were almost 4 dozen ladies in attendance. "It may be too frank for some of you, but I don't care. I miss a good old Friday night fuck. Terry was too quick on the trigger at the start of our relationship, but once I got him trained, he was fine. I had nights where I could pop off 2 little ones and 1 big one before he fired his gun. And afterward, slept like a baby." "Don't your fingers work?" someone asked, to general laughter. "Yes, they do," Rita retorted. She was also laughing, her cheeks as red as apples. "But, darling, they are not the same." This earned her a hearty round of applause, although a few women, Fritz Meeschaum's mousy wife Candy for one, abstained. The 2 big questions came up, of course, in 100 different ways. First, how had they come to be here, in our place? And why? Was it magic? Was it some scientific experiment gone wrong? Was it the will of God? Was their continued existence a reward or a punishment. Why them?
Kitty McDavid was a frequent speaker when the discussion turned in this direction. Kitty's memory of her Aurora's Eve nightmare